vote de moins en moins. Alors pour inverser la tendance, on fait l'inverse de ce qu'on ferait normalement. Normalement, on aurait essayé ben ben fort d'attirer votre attention. Mais pour faire l'inverse, on va essayer pas fort, pas fort. Encore moins fort que ça. Comme ça. Et c'est peut-être en essayant vraiment pas fort d'attirer votre attention qu'on va justement réussir à attirer votre attention. Ouh, ça c'est fort. Le 3 octobre, on inverse la tendance. Tout le monde vote. Un message d'Élections Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. On August 18th of this year, the Israeli military raided the offices of seven Palestinian civil society organizations. They ransacked the offices, stole files and other property, and sealed the doors in an attempt to prevent them from operating. 25 United Nations independent experts issued a declaration on August 24th condemning, quote, Israel's escalating attacks against Palestinian civil society. The declaration continued, These actions amount to severe suppression of human rights defenders and are illegal and unacceptable. These independent experts are calling on UN member states, quote, to take effective measures afforded by international law to put an end to these abuses. David Kattenberg spoke with two of the authors of the August 24th declaration. Francesca Albanese is the special UN rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967. Mary Lawler is special rapporteur on the situation of human rights defenders.
Francesca, you've just taken over recently as a special rapporteur on the human rights situation in the territories occupied by Israel since 1967. It's a very long title. When did you begin and how are you proceeding at the start of your tenure? Where are you at?
I started this with this position on May 1st this year. So I am just past my fourth month as a special rapporteur.
And how are you proceeding?
Well, you know, this first month, as for any position, have involved learning about the position, learning my support team and the partners, including the fellows, special rapporteurs, the commission of inquiry, familiarizing myself with the responsibility and rules that govern this position, trying to establish good relationship with relevant member states and regional groups, civil society, academia, but also I've tried to use this month to elaborate my vision, meaning what kind of special rapporteur I want to be. At the same time, the challenges have been many, have been extreme, because as I started, there was the court ruling which confirmed that the fact that the army could go ahead with the displacement of 1,200 people in Masafer Yatta, the largest incident of forcible transfer since 1967. And a week later, there has been the killing of Shirin Abu Akleh, which is still waiting for a real probe that leads to accountability and justice. There has been a spike of arrest and detention. There have been 130 Palestinians killed from the beginning of this year, of course, including the 49th who were killing in a war that had no legal justification, the recent one in Gaza. So, yeah, I mean, it was quite a busy time for me.
And have you communicated with Israel? Have you told them, introduced yourself and asked to enter into communication and asked to come and visit?
Yes, yes, of course. I've tried to meet with the permanent mission of Israel in Geneva, but unfortunately, the mission has declined my request for a visit. Individually and together with other rapporteurs, I have addressed communications asking about cases of concern that constitute violations of international law, human rights law, or humanitarian law. I personally received no response, and I'm not engaged with the Israeli mission yet for a visit, but I plan to go in the coming months. So definitely I'm going to do so.
And I mean, past rapporteurs, special rapporteurs have not been able to get in since the end of Richard Falk's tenure, right? I mean, Michael Wink wasn't able to get in, and
yes, Michael applied for visa, sought authorization of Israel to facilitate his entry. The fact that Israel, I mean, this non-engagement is more than regrettable. There is a pattern of non-cooperation with the mandate by Israel. While open dialogue among all parties is essential for the protection and promotion of human rights. So this is also an obligation for Israel, and I do hope and expect that the government of Israel will engage with me. If not, at least it will not hamper my work. At least I should be allowed to go to the occupied Palestinian territory, over which it's necessary to remember Israel has no sovereignty. It's just the occupying power.
Mary Lawler, how long have you been special rapporteur on the situation of human rights defenders? And human rights defenders get persecuted and murdered all around the world. There are all sorts of places around the world where being a human rights defender is hazardous, if not potentially lethal. How does Israel compare? The various governments, the EU and its member states, and the UK and Canada and the United States say Israel is a paragon of human rights and democracy. But what's the status of human rights defenders, generally speaking, in Israel today and in the occupied territories?
Thank you for having me. And first of all, I will tell you that I have been in the mandate since May 2020. And in that time, I've written 10 communications, 10 formal letters to Israel about different human rights defenders who have been targeted and whose rights have been violated without any response, including the latest atrocity, for want of a better word, whereby Israel has raided and shut down 7 reputable, credible organized human rights organizations with human rights defenders in them. And I take a people-centered approach to the mandate. I know few of the people involved in this shutdown. I have been to Israel, West Bank and Gaza myself twice, and I try and follow the situation. I've had many meetings with Palestinian human rights defenders over the last 2 years, and also with Israeli human rights defenders who are working on Palestine and other issues. So the kind of things that you, apart from this awful scourge of administrative detention, and, you know, the lack of freedom of expression, the lack of ability to be free from discrimination, the lack of the right to freedom of opinion, of peaceful assembly, of freedom of association. All these rights have been undermined by Israel. And Israel, as you know, is a party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And these kind of rights are protected in these two covenants, which give force to the Universal Declaration. And so Israel is bound by the provisions by being party to these rights. And even if you take something like travel bans, you know, and if you look at the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, one of the rights is the right to physical and mental health. And we've seen so many examples of people who aren't allowed travel. Obviously, my mandate is human rights defenders, but you can see how all the rights are connected between economic, social and cultural rights and civil and political rights when people can't travel for treatment. And, you know, the defenders in Israel, in West Bank and Gaza can't even meet each other because of the and they can't come outside. It's so rare for them to be able to come outside because of travel bans. Some of the communications I did this year, indeed, were on two of the organizations that have been cited as terrorist, the Bissan Center for Research and Development, and Adamir. The director of Adamir and the director of the Bissan Center were both stopped from leaving despite having valid visas. They were both going to the US, and that, you know, they weren't allowed. And then, of course, we have the whole thing about Pegasus, you know, where Pegasus was found on the phones of the director of the Bissan Center and members of Al-Haq and Adamir. So this not only puts them in danger, but it puts all the people that they are in contact with in danger. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a start.
It does. And I mean, I'm Francesca, you may have a comment to add, but I'm wondering whether or not the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, whether they actually say anything specifically about the right of civil society organizations to defend human rights.
There is a specific declaration on human rights defenders, which was adopted unanimously by consensus in 1998, and it is the Declaration on Human Rights Defenders. Its long term is the right of all people and organizations to promote and protect human rights and fundamental freedoms. And Israel has agreed to that. And basically, it sets out the right to defend human rights and gives voice to the rights that are already protected in the covenants. Like, and they are laid out, you know, if you look at freedom of expression, we all know it's Article 19 of the covenant. And the right to freedom of opinion is 19. Peaceful assembly is Article 21. Freedom of association is Article 22, and everyone has the right to participate in public life, and that's Article 25. So, there, you know, all these things are spelled out both in the Declaration on Human Rights Defenders and in the covenants which give force to the Universal Declaration. So, I mean, it's there. It's just that Israel is choosing to disregard it.
Francesca, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would like to add that, in fact, as far as I know, the director of Bissan is an American citizen. So in addition to what Mary said, the restriction, the prevention, the ban on traveling to the U.S. was imposed on a U.S. citizen. And these links to the responsibility of other member states, to third parties, including the United States, to protect its citizens against abuses that might be committed by Israel or others. So what I would also like to say is that I fully agree with Mary with reference to the various provisions that she listed. And I would like to stress that they apply to everyone, every woman and man, regardless of age, without any discrimination. So there is a heightened protection, if we want to call it this way, for human rights defenders, as highlighted by the adoption of this declaration, because over time it has become manifest that not only human rights defenders are necessary to preserve the civic space and the enjoyment of freedom with, as an extra layer of protection between the citizens and the government. This is the rationale, which is eroded. This is why, in the context of occupied Palestine, this is eroded. But also, Israel, is, as an occupying power, is also bound by the provisions to ensure public order and civic life, an orderly civic life under occupation. So not only it's bound under human rights law, but it also has occupying power's responsibilities. So what it's doing toward the civil society is illegal, and it's part and parcel, if I may say, of an increasing tendency to shrink the space of human rights defenders and civil society. Part of the shrinking space is also, as Mary was saying, the mass spywire surveillance to monitor them. And even though there is such a level of surveillance, it's clear that there is nothing, there is no evidence, as we have declared as special rapporteurs in our public statements, there is no evidence of them being terrorists, as they have been accused. There is no evidence of them committing any illicit activity. In fact, there is evidence of the contrary, as demonstrated by various investigations that have been carried out.
And I was going to get to this. I mean, Israel's charges against the six Palestinian groups has been rejected by 9 EU member states in the middle of July. They said information provided to them by Israel lacked substance. No concrete and credible evidence substantiating Israel's allegations has ever been provided. Your own August 24 statement says the European Union's anti-fraud office has confirmed no suspicions of irregularities and or fraud. Even the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States has come up with nothing. And yet Israel continues to oppress, suppress these rights groups, invading their offices, threatening their staff. So my question is, well, I mean, I want to know, how is it that Israel gets away with this? But what do you think Israel's motives are in doing this, right? Alleged membership in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP affiliation, is their go-to reason for targeting human rights defenders. The human rights groups say this charge is completely specious, but is the rationale itself legitimate? Can one target human rights defenders because perhaps at some point when they were younger, they were an activist, a political activist, and the PFLP or any other party?
I think the objective is to neutralize their work, stop their work, and cut off their funding. It's as simple as that. Israel does not want human rights defenders working and documenting and publicizing the attacks and injustice done to the Palestinians. So this is their tactic. And as far as the 9 states are concerned, of course, it is very good that they have come out. But, you know, they really have to use more leverage to stop these aggressive attacks and to get this designation of terrorists rescinded. And they also need to put in place proper political and financial support so that these people can continue to work. Because, for example, Al-Haq is still working, but they've been warned not to. And the next step could easily be that they'd be arrested and they need legal advice and they'll need money to continue the work. And the Netherlands, you know, has been quite weak on the whole issue of the rights of the Palestinian people. So, you know, it would be good if they came more on board. And of course, the US, like one centimeter of the US is worth more than the a meter of the EU. Sorry, Francesca, you're coming in there.
Again, I agree with what Mary said. There is probably another element that that can be added. Because, David, you were asking, what is the rationale? What is the rationale now? Why just now? Because there has been an intensification of measures and efforts in crushing these particular organizations, including raiding their offices and threatening their staff. So these six organizations are at the forefront of the battle for international justice and accountability in the occupied Palestinian territory. So they're also they're collecting evidence through their monitoring and reporting that can be part and parcel of their full engagement in the ongoing situation of Palestine case being investigated by the ICC. And they're also providing assistance to victims of daily violence at the end of the Israeli occupation system, including the armies, but also the settlers. So I do believe that it's legitimate to imagine that there is a link between this attempt at assuring accountability, meaning criminal liability of individuals involved in illegal activities in the OPT, by attacking them and their work, for example, seizing folders, computers. Israel might be, and I quote, destroying, tampering, or interfering with the collection of evidence, end of quote, of war crimes and crimes against humanity. And I'm quoting the statute of the statute of the International Criminal Court. So this might constitute a violation of the administration of criminal justice. So Israel is doing something else, which is absolutely prohibited under international law.
And I mean, you know, you've raised an important point. Israel, the soldiers and police forces, border police have gone into all these offices and they've ransacked them and seized laptops and thumb drives and files that contain lots of highly privileged information and testimony and accounts and personal information pertaining to women and children. Ordinary individuals who are having a hard time of it under permanent military occupation. And the Israeli forces can now use this information. It's like busting into a lawyer's office and seizing all of her or his files, you know, or into a doctor's office and seizing all the files that contain information that's highly privileged. Thoughts on this?
Yes, this is, you know, there are so many problematic aspects. So this is why I say not only it's a violation of human rights, but it's also a violation of the administration of justice. So this will all feed into, I hope, the investigation of the ICC.
Mary?
I agree with everything that Francesca has said. And would just like to endorse that. I mean, it is true. It's much broader and wider than just attacks against individuals. It's a whole suffocation of civil society and human rights defenders, with the ramifications of the ICC and the lack of funding and all the other things that are going in. If you recall, the first organization that was shut down last summer was the Union of Health Work Committees, and that was in August, and it was almost like a trial run for the six that were attacked lately.
Which is astonishing. In the middle of the COVID pandemic, they were arresting health workers.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Salah Hamouri, this individual. He's a member of the Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association. He's been in and out of jail, Israeli prisons, since I think he was like 16 years old. and he's gone through various rounds of administrative detention, and he's just been issued a brand new a dose of administrative detention, has just been renewed. Have you been following his case?
Yeah, I mean, I think special procedures have sent three formal communications on his case, October 20, August 21, November 21, no response from Israel. And you know, the communications expressed concern about the possible revocation of his permanent residency, but the authorities went ahead, ignored that. And then after the official notice was given, we again raised the concerns, and he's, as you said, he's been in detention since 2022. It's very difficult. Maybe Francesca will bring a new breath of fresh air to this, but it's very difficult to have impact on the Israelis because of just the non-engagement.
There are, yeah, totally. I mean, I hope I will be able to bring some fresh air, but it's very difficult because of this pattern of non-engagement, but also because of this sense of acquiescence among the international community, that apart from condemnation toward Israel on what happens, there is very little concrete action. Salah Hamoud is, for me, is emblematic nowadays because it's he's a French Palestinian lawyer, and he's from Jerusalem. So he's been, as you are saying, David, arrested many, many times since he was 16 years old. And the working group on arbitrary detention, which is another, like Maryam, is another special procedure mandate holder, is a collegial body which only looks at cases of detention, has expressed concern over his detention as arbitrary and violating norms of fair trial. Now, this recent administrative detention is particularly worrisome to me because it's based on a secret file, and based on this secret file, he risked the revocation of his residency in Jerusalem on the ground of breach of allegiance to Israel. So why it's worrisome for me? First of all, Israel cannot compel the occupied population, anyone among the occupied people, to swear allegiance to it, because Israel is, like, under international law, is the hostile power, occupying power toward the Palestinians. So it would be a dangerous precedent. But also the revocation of residency for Jerusalemites is unfortunately happening. It's not new, but it has not happened on a secret file yet. And this is why it's absolutely important that there is a strong response and strong mobilization on Salah's case.
And Salah Hamouri, he was born in Jerusalem.
Yes. Yeah, so his life is in Jerusalem. So his mom is French. But, I mean, his center of life, sticking to the vocabulary in the Israeli procedures, his center of life is Jerusalem. So I do not see why Israel should go ahead on this revocation. You know, there are, if someone makes any wrongdoing, there is a law to comply with, fine. But the way Israel engages with particular individuals, especially human rights defenders, is prima facie persecutorial to me.
And he's being held in Hadarim prison, I understand, inside Israel, within the Green Line. I mean, along with, you know, hundreds and hundreds, I think most Palestinian detainees, prisoners, are being held inside prisons inside the Green Line, which is flagrantly illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention.
This is correct. This is correct. The occupied population should not be detained outside the occupied territory. But, you know, it's the overall situation of the deprivation of liberty, arrest and detention in the occupied Palestinian territory is extremely problematic because, first of all, it's there is a large recourse to arrest and detention, which in a significant number of cases is then condemned as arbitrary by a number of national and international observers, and it's on the basis of a problematic terror anti-terrorism legislation, which is also often abused. So because this is so, the magnitude of the problem is such, this is why I've decided to focus on the deprivation of liberty in all its manifestation in the OPT in my next report.
Do you think, I mean, talking about specific things that the international community can do you think that they should consider or actually proceed to rescind the terrorist designation against the PFLP? I'm not sure if you want to weigh in on this, but, you know, the EU and its member states and Canada and the United States formally consider the PFLP to be a terrorist organization, and it is the go-to organization if you want to accuse a human rights defender of terrorism and throw them in jail. Label them as a PFLP activist. It's the whole rationale behind the targeting of the six Palestinian organizations. So might there be a good sense for the international community to rescind this designation?
Look, the designation of terrorism is not uncommon to a situation like the one the Palestinians are experiencing, meaning one of subjugation, people under foreign rule for decades. This is a tool that powers in a dominant position use to advance the repression of the subjugated population. We shouldn't forget that even Nelson Mandela was considered a terrorist in apartheid South Africa. I'm not sure I want to comment necessarily on the designation of this particular party because I think that the question should be broader. Israeli's presence in the OPT is what triggers this instability and this level of violence. Because as I've said before, in order to keep an entire people under occupation for 55 years, you need a lot of violence because you are repressing their rights every day. And of course, this will trigger violence in response. There is only one way to bring peace to that place, and it's by ensuring freedom. And freedom, we get to freedom through complying with international law. International law, and this is what the most central point to me to answer your question, David. People have a right to self-determination. The Palestinian people have the right of self-determination, which is ultimately the right to exist as a people and also the right to resist as a people. And therefore, any consideration of the designation of terrorism, how to approach political forces on the ground should be addressed against this background. What are the means for the Palestinians to resist the occupation? First and foremost, the international law should be the guide for it. And the Palestinians, frankly, over time have resorted to peaceful resistance, legal resistance. Look at the work of the six NGOs. And even that is impossible to protect. This is a dangerous signal that we are sending to the Palestinians under occupation.
Do occupied people or oppressed, subjugated people have the right to resist?
Yes.
Under international law?
They do. They do. And it has been firmly and repeatedly affirmed by the United Nations General Assembly as of the 60s. This is from the 60s, actually from the 50s and 60s and through the 70s. These are the years of the decolonization process, where the equality of all people and the self-determination of all people has been firmly recognized, and any foreign rule or alien domination has been condemned and has been prohibited, and even recognized as an act of aggression by the United Nations. So while this was happening, David, within the United Nations, within the General Assembly, the Palestinians were experiencing, as of 1967, a new type of those manifestations that today we do not hesitate to define colonialism, occupying a people's territory, preventing them from exercising the right of self-determination, seizing their resources, exploiting them, preventing the enjoyment of any basic rights. I mean, this is what determines, first of all, an obligation of all states to act in support of the Palestinians, but also this leads to recognize a right to resist of the Palestinians, because they are a population under a prolonged and unlawful occupation.
Is this apartheid? Do you use that word?
I do, yes. I mean, it's fully documented that Israel has been practicing the crime of apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territory and over the Palestinians more broadly. This has been documented by the Palestinians and Israeli international organizations, reputable international organizations, including my predecessor. And there has been this discussion concerning apartheid, frankly, since John Dugard. John Dugard was the first special rapporteur on occupied Palestinian territory to use the concept of apartheid. Said Israel, I think it was in 2007, Israel, some of the practices that Israel imposes over the Palestinian, I mean, I'm not quoting verbatim, but resemble apartheid. It was in 2007. And the situation has only gone worse. So my point is, yes, it is apartheid, but the dismantlement of the apartheid, which is necessary, is not the only thing that is to be pursued, because there is also, again, Palestinians have the sovereignty over the occupied Palestinian territory, which was a compromised position. The PLO came to between the late 80s and the 90s. There is international consensus that it should be that, and which doesn't, again, this is said with no prejudice to the right of self-determination of the Palestinians outside the OPT. But within the occupied territory, it's clear that Israel has no sovereignty, so it has no right to keep any presence, including not only military, but also the settlements.
Francesca Albanese and Mary Lawler, thank you so much for joining me today.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. This week, I had the pleasure of speaking with Shireen Davis. Shireen is an award-winning Palestinian-American film and television director, writer, and actress. Shireen's first film, Amrika, premiered in 2009 and won a dozen international awards. Shireen has since gone on to direct Emmy Award-winning television shows such as Hulu's Rami and Netflix's Ozark, and has written for Empire, Quantico, and The L Word. Shireen also guest stars on Mo, comedian Mo Ahmed's new half-hour comedy show for Netflix, where Shireen plays the role of Mo's older sister. Most recently, Shireen was nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Directing in a Comedy Series for the critically acclaimed episode The Boy from 6B on Hulu's Only Murders in the Building. This episode is told from the perspective of a deaf character and with only one line of spoken dialogue. To do this, Shireen relied on ASL, compelling visuals, and the soundtrack to tell the story. In addition to her directing work on season one, Shireen has directed two episodes of season two. The Emmys will take place on September the 12th.
Welcome, Shireen. I can't believe I'm actually speaking to you.
Oh, thank you so much. So sweet. I'm so happy to be here. Are you kidding?
I've been fanning on you for such a long time. This is a highlight for me. For Shireen, huge, huge, huge congratulations on your Emmy nomination.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. And your role in Mo. Tell me about it. How did that all come about?
You know, I'm such a huge fan of Mo's. I just love him. And I worked with him on Rami. And so, you know, and I worked with Rami and know Rami. I heard about the series and I just put out there that I was, you know, I would love to be involved in this in any way. Yeah. When I heard that, you know, he was looking for someone to play his older sister, it was just like, yeah, please consider me. Like, I put myself forward. And in fact, I didn't even like at all happen through my representatives. And then when I sent in my audition tape, I just reached out to Rami and Mo and was like, hey, I just put myself on tape for this. Just letting you know, like, look out for it. I just really wanted to be involved in the show in whatever way I could be, because it was like, it's just so huge for us. What a huge historical moment and kind of milestone in representation for Palestinians. And I just feel like it's something I personally wanted and kind of was trying, like, had been working for in my career. So I was just so thrilled to actually get to be in front of the camera as well, like, just to do something I don't normally get to do and to represent in a, you know, entirely different way, which was a lot of fun, like, really a lot of fun. You know, directing can be, sometimes it's almost like a parental role, you know, like, you're the responsible one and you're in charge of everything. And then, you know, getting to be in front of the camera just feels a little bit more like playful and, you know, like, oh, I'm going to let someone else do all the work. Like, I can just have fun now. It was awesome.
So let's step back a second. How did you get into TV and film?
Well, I, you know, it's interesting because in some ways, from the time I was a kid, I was just obsessed with storytelling. It was just, whether it was like bedtime stories, making up stories, telling stories, and watching television and going to see films. Like, I just was one of those kids that would look at the TV screen and go, that's what I want. And I didn't really know what it even meant. I mean, I had no idea what it meant. It was just something that was so clear to me very early on. But it wasn't really until, well, a few things happened. One is that I think growing up first generation in the United States mostly, but going back and forth between, you know, small town Ohio and Jordan and, you know, early on in my life, the West Bank as well. I think I took on, you know, this kind of role as an observer. You know, I was not really American enough for the Americans, and I was not really Arab enough for the Arabs. So I fell kind of in between these two cultures, and that perspective lent itself to my stepping back and just observing things. And I didn't really realize, but that was kind of the very beginning of storytelling for me. Like, in some ways, just observing and kind of being, creating distance in order to tell a story. Like, that was it just was such a natural, you know, kind of thing to do from that point of view, was just like tell the story and comment on like what I thought was funny as I was like observing things. My parents bought a like camcorder when I was 12, and they handed it to me because they were like, well, Shireen will figure out how to make it work. And I did. Like, I was that kid who would just read the manual front to back. So I read it, and my parents had me videotaping really boring things. And I just one day started telling people what to do on camera to make it more fun. And that became a way for me to show like my friends in the United States, like, oh, look at this thing I shot in Jordan, or, oh, you know, show my Arab family, like, oh, look at this thing that we did in the US. Like, it was just a way to kind of bridge the cultures. And I didn't really know what I was doing at that time. I had no idea that that was the beginnings of my becoming a filmmaker or a storyteller or a director. And then the first Gulf War hit in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And that was really the moment where it was like a super like important political awakening for me, but also a real awakening in terms of me understanding the importance of media. Mm-hmm. Because overnight, we went from friends and neighbors to, you know, terrorists and threat and, you know, who knows. You know, my family, we'd been living in the small town for, I think, like 10 years at that point, or even longer. And we started getting death threats on a daily basis, really horrible rumors circulating, like, my dad's son is fighting, you know, in Saddam Hussein's army. My dad has five daughters. And my mom people were calling my mom the Arab bitch, and they weren't like, she would be kicked out of stores, like grocery stores or whatever. It was really, really bad. I mean, Enrique's partly inspired by what happened during that time, but what happened in real life is actually so much worse than what happens in the film. The worst part actually was when the Secret Service came to my high school to investigate a rumor that my older sister threatened to kill the president. I remember my parents having like whispered conversations about moving away. Like really, they were desperately trying to figure out where to go. Like they felt very unsafe. And my dad, who apparently, you know, I mean, he was losing patients at his practice. He's a pediatrician. His name is Nazi. People were calling him the Palestinian Nazi. It was so bad for a period of time that I just remember thinking to myself, why? Like, why are people thinking this about us? Like, what on earth would make them think that we, who have been their neighbors, friendly neighbors for all of this time, would suddenly be threats, like suddenly be threatened? You know, my dad, who actually at the time couldn't even bring himself to buy a gun to protect his family, he bought two baseball bats and put them behind like the front door and the back door. Like, what would make people think that he was a threat? And really the only thing I could, the only conclusion I could come to was film and television, was the media, was the press, was the way in which we were being painted and misrepresented. I became so angry about it and so impassioned to do something about it that was really the moment. I mean, I think it was like 13 or 14 at the time. That was the moment where I vowed. I was like, I'm telling our story. There's just nothing remotely authentic out there as far as representation of Arabs, let alone Palestinians. I mean, talk about the most misunderstood of all Arabs, you know, especially at that time in small town Ohio.
And so you then go on and pursue, you go on to study film at Columbia University and then go on to a fabulous directing, acting, and writing career. And now here we are with your Emmy nomination. Can you talk a little bit about your experience directing Murders in the Building, which I think is fantastic, by the way?
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, you know, it's really interesting because I think one of the things that I became really aware of when I went off to film school, you know, so this thing happened in small town Ohio and I was like 14 or something. It took me about 10 years to finally get off to film school. And, you know, film school is really a time where you're trying to figure out like who you are, who you are as an artist, who you are as a storyteller, who you are, like what your voice is, essentially. And one of the things I think I realized was, as a Palestinian, you know, we're so politicized, like there's just no way to escape politics. Like even when you want to, even when you're just like, I really don't want to talk about this right now. You know, from the time that you're young, it's just like, I mean, especially living in the diaspora, you know, I didn't grow up under occupation. So that's a whole other thing. But in the diaspora, it's like you tell people you're Palestinian, either they don't know where it is, like at least in the 80s, it was like either they didn't know where it was or they thought you said Pakistan or they...
Been there.
Yeah, right? It's a joke in Mo, right? In the series, it made it into the series because so many had that experience. But it's like either they just don't know anything about it or they want to know about it. And suddenly it's your job to educate them, you know, and they're like, what do you think of what's happening over there? And it becomes like some sort of a political conversation or education. And I think that when I arrived in film school, I just remember going, I just want people to know who we are. Like, I just want to tell stories about like everyday people. And I really wanted to tell the story about what happened to my family during the first Gulf War, like just a story that was inspired by what happened to my family during that time. I realized that the best way into that story was through humor. I tried to tell it without humor and it was really bad. It was just really heavy-handed. People weren't interested. I wasn't even interested, to tell you the truth. Like, I started writing it and I just thought, this is not right. I needed to find a way in that felt a little lighter and that brought humor and that just didn't take itself too seriously. And what I realized was like, that's kind of who I am as a storyteller. What I discovered during that time was like, I want to tell stories that have heart and humor because that's how I feel I can get I can reach people. All of that to say, like, I really started gravitating towards comedy. I really started to want to study comedy and understand comedy and watch comedy. I think comedy is just like underappreciated in our culture in so many ways. Like, I feel like it's maybe becoming more and more appreciated. And I'm speaking mostly about like the industry. For us Palestinians, like, humor is such an important part of survival. And that was something that I really wanted to like show. So when I got the opportunity to like direct a show like Only Murders in the Building, I was like, hell yeah. Like, that sounds amazing. Like, to be able to work with comedy legends. I mean, it was like a masterclass in comedy, just watching them work, seeing what they brought to it, understanding how the choices they made in delivering like a line of dialogue, and then getting to really kind of stretch my own comedy chops was really, really exciting to me. And I think it's really interesting just to combine that with my own identity and my own background, knowing that at some point I would like to make like a broad Palestinian comedy, like something that is a much more of a comedy than the films that I've made in the past. So, and then on top of that, I was offered the episode of Only Murders in the Building, which showcased the point of view of a deaf character. And for me, you know, I became a storyteller really in order to represent my community. But what I've discovered is it's not just my community, like it's all communities that are misrepresented and underrepresented, because we have to lift each other up. We all need each other. And so, you know, from working on, you know, the queer series, The L Word, or, you know, the African-American series Empire, just all of these different experiences that I've been able to have that have taught me a lot as a writer, as a director, as an actor. And then ultimately then to be able to do this episode from the point of view of a deaf character and really take on this great responsibility to authentically represent yet another community that has been really underrepresented and misrepresented was amazing and something that really interested me.
And then from there, you know, what struck me in just what you just said was mm-hmm. Palestine, as you know, is it's so tragic that it could be a comedy. And
yeah,
there's so many aspects of daily life here that really the only way that you can survive is by either finding faith or finding some sort of humor, or perhaps both. It's a little bit on the, you know, it's not a little bit, it's completely crazy. So you mentioned that you want to work a comedy series. Any thoughts that you have on it? Is there anything that's in the works?
Well, I do. I mean, I do have a series that I am developing that's based on a Palestinian American family that does involve going back to Palestine. It does involve being in Palestine. And it's a half hour comedy. And it's women, like a lot of female, really strong female characters, which I think is something that I'm particularly good at, is writing strong Arab women. So that's something that I'm working on. It's been a lot of years of me kind of dancing around Sohad Amri's book, Sharon and My Mother-in-Law.
Ah, yes. Okay.
And yeah, so funny enough, it was announced back in 2013 that I was going to adapt that book. And then all of these extenuating circumstances, like just for whatever reason, it ended up not happening then. And then the book came back to me a second time, and it ended up not happening again. The book has come back to me a third time. And so this time I am actually working with producers to get that project off the ground. And I'm excited about it because it is exactly what you're saying. Like, it really is finding the comedy and the absurdity in the everyday life of Palestinians and of, like, you know, occupation. And this particular story takes place during the 2002 incursion in Ramallah. So, you know, it's a very specific period of time in which Ramallah was under curfew for 40 some days. Is that right?
That's right. I remember it well. Yes, 42 days with it lifted on and off for a couple of hours every 3 days, just enough time for us to scramble to the market and beat each other up like it's Boxing Day, like it's the, you know, what is it? Black Friday.
Black Friday. Oh my God. Nightmare. It's interesting, right? Given where the world is at and how after COVID and lockdown and worldwide curfew, more and more people could relate to that story now more than ever.
You know, you mentioned earlier on that you feel that this is a historic moment. It's a breakthrough moment with Mo, the series that has happened. What impact do you think this is going to have on the future of Palestinians in the media? Do you think that it's going to stop there? Is it going to change? Is it going to be the same? Because there have been a few Palestinians in the media, some excellent ones. But what is specific about this moment?
Well, I think what's specific about what's happening at this particular moment is, like, it's on the heels of so much of, you know, people have been doing incredible work to get us to where we are. I mean, and it's taken every single one of us to get to where we are. Every single one of us, you know, whether doing something big or small, whatever contribution that we've made, you know, IMEU has been doing unbelievable work. You've been doing unbelievable work. You know, even me making Amrika, I felt like that was my attempt of, like, let's, you know, putting a Palestinian family story out into the world. And it's been just decades and decades of people doing this kind of work on, you know, on all levels. And I mean, it's interesting as someone who, and you probably, I feel like you can't be Palestinian and not be on some level a media critic and a media expert in the way in which Arabs and Palestinians in particular are portrayed, because we have been suffering from horrific portrayal and misinformation and total erasure. And I mean, so many things. And so from the time that, like, I was a kid, I've been, like, really looking at this and studying this. And it's sort of amazing to see it change. Like, I remember when Amrika came out right after Obama was elected and he was being inaugurated. It was, and Amrika was at Sundance. And it was the first time that a major media outlet, 60 Minutes, did a story on what it meant to be a Palestinian living under occupation.
I remember
Right? It was 2009. And that was a huge moment for us. Like, I mean, I remember being like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, whoa. I mean, it's so sad on some level that excites us, but this is how starved we've been for some, like, just a little bit of truth, a little bit of our story, a little bit of authentic representation, a little bit of just acknowledgement of our suffering and what we've been through. Last year, last May, June, I mean, it was like after all of these, like, bombardments of Gaza, it feels like the tide has been turning in the U.S. And you've got people like Amen, and you've got, you know, for MSNBC, and you've got all of these just amazing people who are really pushing the boundaries and really fighting for the change, really fighting to tell the stories that need to be told. And I just feel like people's eyes are opening in a way that we've not seen before. I mean, I definitely felt that last year. There is definitely a level of awareness now that there never was, and things are shifting in a way. So Mo is arriving at a critical moment, and it's a critical moment where it feels like we're on the brink of just, it feels like something so huge, just this precipice. It just feels like we're, like, on the brink of something, you know, like we have, like, how many people in Congress now who are actually fighting for justice in Palestine, who are talking about Palestine, you know, challenging Israel. And it's, these things are all amazing. But then to have a series like Mo come at a time when we are at this precipice, I think is just so important, because popular culture is, I mean, it really does, it sets the tone. I mean, it really does, it shifts everything. It really has the ability to create change in people's hearts and minds. So, I mean, the fact that it's, like, been in the top 10 on Netflix is massive.
Well, and it goes back to what you were saying earlier, which is what changed your life was the way in which Arabs were being portrayed during the first Gulf War, during 1990, 1991. And so now to see that shift is, it's like we've crossed a threshold, or at least I hope we have. At least I hope
yes.
we have. Yes.
No, yeah. And I think kind of the word, the phrase I was looking for was, like, we've arrived at this precipice where we're so close to really, really crossing it fully. Like, it feels like we're, you know, we're teetering, and sometimes it feels like we're over it, and sometimes it feels like we're not quite, you know, but it does, it feels like a show like Mo coming out at this moment could really get us over that threshold.
So, last question, have you found a place where you're going to put the Emmy?
Oh my God, that's hilarious. I'm so thrilled to just be nominated and to be going to the Emmys, and I'm in disbelief. Funny enough, full of, like, awards that I've gotten in the past for my films I've given to my mother, and they live in Jordan, which I feel is really appropriate. My mom lives in Jordan, so they'll probably give it to my mom.
Well, I hope you put a Palestinian flag. I hope you have her carrying the Palestinian flag as...
Oh, yeah. We'll bring any Palestinian flag for sure. And we'll put it up somewhere. We're near a window.
All right, Shireen. Well, thank you. I really have taken up way too much of your time.
No, it was so great to talk to you.
And to you, too.
Thank you so much.
Take care. All right.
You too.
Bye-bye. Yeah.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Hey, all you hip-hop heads. NDG's favorite urban music festival is back. Prévention Côté Neige NDG and Elementality are proud to present the 18th edition of Hip Hop You Don't Stop, ending the summer on a high note with a weekend full of performances, art showcases, dance battles, and community gathering. Featured artists include Mackie Lavender, Miriam Sassy, Remy Picasso, Shades Lawrence, DJ Pro V, and more. It's all going down Friday, September 16th to Sunday, September 18th, and it's all free. Visit linktree.com/HHYDS Montreal for more information and stay connected, because hip hop doesn't stop here. Hip Hop You Don't Stop is brought to you with the support of Canadian Heritage and La Ville de Montréal, a CKUT co-presentation.
To Hotel the Blues, you're on 90.3 CKUT FM. To get tonight's program started off, we're going to turn to the king and perhaps one of my favorite kings of the blues scene.
Nice world to visit, but not to live in. Same old thing from day to day. Sometimes I wonder if I shouldn't just give in, instead of going on this way. Who wants to live this way? Who wants to live this way? Nobody wants to hear what you gotta say. It's a repeat of what they said yesterday.